Thank you so much for joining us, Edgar.
No problem, Ruby.
Oh, thank you. Now, as I mentioned before, the idea of housing affordability. So how exactly does that influence someone's decision to live with their relatives?
Yeah, so when we did our research, we did a survey and we asked people for what reasons they decided to live together. And basically more than half of them said that financial reasons was one of the big drivers. And that included a whole range of things, including housing affordability. It's not just a matter of not being able to afford to rent or buy on their own, but it could also be influenced by other factors, including change to our work environment, for example. As you know, many of your listeners would know, a lot of our work is now on short-term contract, or even in the gig economy, which makes it actually very difficult to even access a home loan, even if we are earning a reasonable amount of income on short periods.
Yeah, absolutely. So I imagine some are kind of forced to move back in or have relatives move in, but despite financial pressures, which we just talked about, do you think some families just kind of crave that connection?
Yeah, definitely do. And like I said, when we asked for what reasons, they had a space to write whatever they wanted. And then we backcoded into different categories. And the second most common reason was to provide companionship and support. So it's just to have that company around. And one of the answers we struggled to put in the category, and basically Jesus said, oh, well, we're family, so we just wanted to live together.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so talking about grandparents and elders, you know, there's a lot less desire amongst this age group to go into institutional aged care. And of course, after quite a few horror stories in the media, there's no surprise at all for that one. So do you think that plays a role in why elderly people might live in multi-generational households?
Definitely, because when we started our research, we wanted to look at a whole range of different drivers, so what we call structural drivers or policy drivers. And the changes to our care policies, whether it's to do with childcare or disability care or aged care, that has changed a lot in this country over the last 20 years. A lot of the services or support that we get now is home-based rather than at institutions like a retirement village or a nursing home. So you really kind of need to do that. And to qualify, you often need to be of what they consider high needs. So if you're on a lower needs, you only need occasional care. You don't necessarily qualify for those institutions. And one way of providing that help is within the family. And that's part of the reason why a lot of the older people are now living in multi-generational households. Certainly over the last 30 years, the biggest increase in terms of age group-wise is in the older age groups.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, I mentioned before, because like my background is half Croatian, and multi-generational living kind of hasn't really been it's not really a new concept for my family. And I know that a lot of migrant families, it's kind of the same thing. So do you think the multicultural diversity of families in Australia might be a factor in this trend as well?
Yeah, certainly. From our census analysis, we did find that people from particular backgrounds are more likely to live in a multi-generational household. So if you were born in the Middle East, for example, more than a third of the of our migrants from the Middle East actually live in a multi-generational households. And like you said, you know, there is a very strong cultural element there, because there's this expectation that you would help out your family when you need to, or you know, whether you need to or not, or whether you want to or not either. But we also found out that two-thirds of the people who live in multi-generational households were born in Australia or New Zealand, which means that, you know, it could be, you know, second generation or third generation people of Greek, Italian background, for example, which also has this kind of tradition.
Yeah, of course. So I'm sure that living in the same household probably isn't every family's cup of tea, which, fair enough. So what are some of the difficulties that you found in your study that do make it a kind of unsuitable option?
Well, one of the big issues is the design of our housing, which causes a whole range of different problems, because this kind of living arrangement hasn't been on our minds for the last, you know, quite a few decades. We haven't been designing homes to suit this particular lifestyle, particularly in the last 15, 20 years, we've kind of preferred more the open plan living, which means that, you know, a number of rooms that form kind of one giant space where there's no audio or visual privacy. So if you really want to be by yourself for a few minutes, you really need to find a space to hide away, and most likely that would be the bedroom. And so lack of privacy was one of the big issues that people talked about. It was actually the biggest dislike that they had when we asked them what they don't like about living in a multi-generational household.
Yeah, right. So if more people do choose to live in multi-generational households, what kinds of policy changes would we need to accommodate them? And then as well, like multi-generational living obviously isn't for everyone. And over the course of time, I think people have kind of been pushed more towards this kind of individualistic mindset in terms of becoming an adult and growing up. So how could what kind of policy changes could also do you think we'd need to accommodate that as well?
Well, there are a number of ways. So one is a policy perspective, one is a housing design perspective. So let's start with housing, because we've just been talking about that. We probably need to provide a greater variety of housing. At the moment, there are either the really big detached homes on the outer fringe or the middle suburbs of our cities, and then there are the really small apartments towards the middle of our city where most of the new housing is being provided at the moment. And those kind of one- and two-bedroom apartments aren't really suitable to a whole range of family situations, let alone multi-generational household. So we probably need to set some kind of regulations or directions or guidelines so that we actually provide a greater variety of apartments out there rather than just really small households, really small apartments, expecting that only small households would live in apartments. And there are implications in terms of service access as well. So a lot of what we found was that if there is an older person within the multi-generational household, and in order to accommodate them, they need to live in a relatively larger house, and you can really only afford those in the outer fringe suburbs, which means that the older person might not be able to get the access to services that they require or even just the social support that they require, because it might be too far for them to walk or to catch a bus to the local service center. And so if you provide a greater variety of apartments, it makes it a lot easier for them to use public transport to get to the support that they require. And then from the policy perspective, we probably need to have a greater recognition that there are a wider variety of families out there. And just because the family is providing the care doesn't mean that they themselves don't need support to provide that care. Particularly, you know, like I said, a lot of the reasons that people live together is for financial reasons. So if they can't actually afford to purchase that kind of support that they require, then the government would need to step up and provide some kind of assistance to help them get that support.
Of course, of course. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Edgar. It's been really great having you on the show.
You're welcome.